Okay, is Alaska becoming an agricultural state? I'm serious. The last time we did a show about this issue, we got all kinds of calls. Hello, I'm Steve Heimel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, it's a local call at 3-550-8422. Email is talk@aprn.org. We're going to talk about local sources of food on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
Well, I look forward to this time every year because it's right when the Bioneers Conference comes up, and they are always willing to provide one of their speakers to be on Talk of Alaska. And this time, the speaker is going to be someone from Chicago who is into food security, into secure food, and into locality of food. And we'll be talking with her shortly. But first, I want to introduce Ellen Mailing, a volunteer at the Bioneers Conference. Ellen, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to be here.
So, are you worked up about this local food situation?
Well, I am, because I think it's been remarkable, kind of the resurgence in folks gardening in their own homes and yards, doing what they can to produce food.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, we've seen a huge increase in the level of farmers markets just in this summer alone. I think probably tripling the number of external markets for people to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables from primarily valley farmers. And a number, you know, lastly, too, certainly on a national level, people are realizing that having access to good, healthy produce, whole grains, all that other stuff is a critical both social justice issue for everyone and also just in terms of your overall health.
It's interesting you brought up social justice, and I probably will come circling back to that. But, you know, I'm wondering, it strikes me that, you know, we do this show, people call up, sometimes a lot call up and sometimes very few call up. And whenever we bring up energy, they just start calling because they have ideas and they're excited about this issue. And when we started, you know, our gardening shows have always been popular, but when we started more specifically to this local food issue, we were absolutely deluged mm-hmm. with calls. So what this tells me, you know, as a talk show person, is that there's tremendous public interest in this. And that's, you know, what you said, we're seeing it resurging all over the place. I'm wondering, what do we do about the policy side of it? You know, it seems to me like they're a little slow.
Right.
You know, I mean, for instance, we found when we did our last show on this food security issue that there are farms where people can make an arrangement with the farmer ahead of time, help them buy their seeds and so forth, and get a share of the harvest. They're all booked up.
Right.
So where is the policy machinery to encourage this to grow faster? You were mentioning farmers markets. Well, you know, slowly there's getting to be more. It seems like it'd be nice if there was a policy framework to make it grow even faster.
Yeah. Well, I think in one of the important, you know, social change adages I've always looked at is if people lead, the leaders will follow. And I think more and more we're seeing an increased demand for people wanting to ensure that all people have access to good, healthy food, and particularly that's growing locally.
People lead. Oh, that's a mantra.
Yeah. The other piece, too, is, you know, one thing that Bioneers on a national and local level has been really focused on is innovative and positive solutions for people and planet. And so the approach of Bioneers is really to put the stories of people that are making a positive difference in the world out there and really celebrating and recognizing every person's contribution toward doing their small part.
Well, our last Bioneers guest was Catherine Austin Fitz, and she came in here and she said, I was at the meeting where the financial services industry decided to pump and dump the American economy. I said, well, where should we invest? She said, put it in something hard. Boy, that's prophetic. Yeah. Let's turn to the guest we have this time. LaDonna Redmond is with us. She is with the Institute for Community Resource Development in Chicago. LaDonna, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi. Well, thank you for having me.
I think we'd like to start by just having you tell your story, how you ever came to be a grocery proprietor with the weird name Graffiti and Grub.
Well, that's quite a long story. I don't know how long your show is.
It's an hour long, and I know you're going to have to leave me early, but so give us a condensed version.
I'll give you the Cliff Note version.
Thank you.
Of that story. I was listening earlier a minute ago, and Ellen said something I think which is really is a mantra, is that if the people lead, the policymakers follow. For me, the personal has always been political, but until you have a personal connection to something, people generally don't make a political commitment. For me, my journey into the food system began when I realized that my son, who had developed food allergies and required a particular kind of food, mainly food that was, didn't have eggs or shellfish or milk in it, and could not eat anything processed pretty much at 6 months old, I realized that I was looking for this food and couldn't find it in my community. And what really kind of came from that realization was the political part of it. I could go outside of my community and grocery shop. Certainly, I had a car and I, you know, had a family and resources, but someone who didn't have the things that I had could not access the healthiest varieties of food around. And what I was looking for was organic fruits and vegetables. I wanted fresh fruits and vegetables for my baby. I didn't want food that was genetically modified. I didn't want food that had been grown with a lot of pesticides. And I definitely, you know, was very aware of chemical fertilizers, and I didn't want food that was grown that way either. So that meant that I wanted organic food, and at that time, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of definition, and I don't even think that the national standards were in place at that point, even though there was lots of discussion about those standards. And that led me to the realization that some communities don't have access to the best quality of food for whatever reason, be it economic or policy issues, but they don't have the access, and we have to change that, and that's been what I've been working on.
Yeah, you know, that up to this point kind of sounds like the tale of your basic co-oper. You know, I remember I became a co-oper for similar reasons, as I just couldn't get the foods that I really wanted unless I gardened it myself or unless I joined with people of similar persuasion, and we formed a co-op and purchased it, you know, wholesale. And I got to really like that whole process, but it sounds like the route you took to get to something called Graffiti and Grub was even more creative.
I don't know if it was creative. I think we ruled out all the possibilities along the way.
Last resort, huh?
Right. It was the last door to open, actually. But one of the ideas, I think, that that came through the process that we went through, and this was a community effort. When I say me or I, you know, I really am not talking about just myself. There were hundreds of other people who were involved in this effort to build a community-owned grocery store or even begin looking at this issue. So it's just really more than just me. But I remember at one community meeting, particularly in the community that I'm from, which was the Austin community at that time, folks didn't really want, they didn't want a major chain grocery store to come in and just build a store. So they didn't want to start a campaign to get one of the major chains to build the grocery store. They felt that those stores had already abandoned them, and they didn't feel, you know, that they should invite them to come back. The other thing is that the phrase co-op or cooperatives doesn't stick in Chicago for whatever reason. And so the word co-op and cooperative really sounded social service-y to the community, and they didn't want that either. They wanted a grocery store. they wanted a grocery store that would respond to them, that would hire their kids and provide the food in the neighborhood that they wanted to that they wanted.
Wow, yeah, that sounds great.
That sounds absolutely great.
I mean, especially
somehow
when you
I got stuck with the job of doing this. I'm not quite sure what meeting that was.
So it's hiring the. Yeah, I mean, especially when you start talking about local hire, you know, that makes everybody perk up. But I understand that graffiti and grub goes to the point where you actually have people from the neighborhood who are going out and participating in the production of the food.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, part of my journey has been one where I began to understand the complete food system. I think one of the issues that we have to face is that many people, just regular citizens, and that includes our policymakers, don't understand where our food comes from, even though they know that it, you know, it comes from someplace beyond the grocery store. But they don't understand where or how we get our food, and they don't understand that there's a whole system in place designed to distribute and package food to us. And I began to understand the food system. So I understood that, one, retail was one aspect of the food system, but it's probably the place where, you know, consumers are most deceived, because it looks like we're dealing with variety and plenty when we really aren't. We're dealing with, you know, maybe four food companies making the majority of the products in a given aisle.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a very similar. My co-op adventure led me to become a produce buyer, and once I was a produce buyer for the co-op, and would go down to the wholesale market every once a week, I quickly discovered, you know, that there were the other buyers were also going down there, and I suddenly had a dimmer view of what I was seeing on my supermarket shelves.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily because they were bad buyers, but because that was what was available, period.
Exactly. And if everyone could have that kind of experience, then you become more appreciative of the farmer in your life, or connecting to the land and things like that. But my point to all of that was to say that one of the projects that we worked on early on was to convert vacant lots to urban farm sites, so that the food would become readily available quickly, as opposed to us waiting, you know, 10 years to build a grocery store and really look at the other areas of access. So what we did was we converted vacant lots to urban farm sites and grew food that way. We coordinated a local farmers market and linked up with some African-American farmers from Pembroke, which is 70 miles south of Chicago, going toward Champaign-Urbana, and got them to come to our farmers markets on Saturdays, and we sold the produce that we grew on the urban farm sites. And we also worked with a community-supported agriculture farm called Angelic Organics, and they brung in a box program. So we did a lot of things to try to get people to the farmers market, get people into some additional ways of purchasing food beyond just going to the retail supermarket.
All right. Our guest, LaDonna Redmond of the Community Institute for Community Resource Development in Chicago. LaDonna, how in the world did you pay for something like that? This is starting to sound really expensive.
It was very expensive. We were fortunate to get support from a lot of the local foundations. The first foundation to really step up was the Chicago Community Trust. They gave us the $250,000 grant to convert the six initial gardens, vacant lots to gardens. And then the Kellogg Foundation provided an additional $800,000 to actually research and better understand the issue of food access, as well as support the salaries of staff to work on those projects. So those were the two big funders, and then Robert Wood Johnson and a couple of other funders stepped up.
All right, I want to break in here to put in the phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. The email is talk@APRN.org, and it's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. An email from Charles in Sitka, who says that, first off, if you need to talk to someone about what we're doing for food security in Sitka, there's the Sitka Local Foods Network. And I said Carrie McLean is probably going to be here for the for the Bioneers Conference, which is coming up when, Ellen?
Well, that actually starts on Friday afternoon and goes all the way through Sunday, late Sunday afternoon at UAA Wendy Williamson Auditorium.
Okay, and this is one of those deals for those that don't know where there's national speakers that you'll have like some big screen and people will be able to be an audience, an additional audience for this national, but you don't stop with that. You bring in people like LaDonna.
We do. And in addition, there's local workshops as well. So I did want to encourage folks, if they're curious and they want to stop by, we have a program called The Taste of Bioneers. You can attend a specific session in a particular day for only $20. It's a great way to get a shot in the arm on getting connected with these issues on a broader level. Of course, you know, people are welcome to come by for just a day or register for the entire conference as well. We are having a couple of keynote speakers. Of course, LaDonna will be speaking Saturday night at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in conjunction with a Thank Our Farmer dinner that we're orchestrating with UAA Dining Services. And we'll be inviting a number of farmers to come so that we can eat their produce and recognize them for their contributions.
I really like the idea that you're getting the culinary kids involved, too.
Right.
I love that whole concept that they've got this culinary school over there at the university.
That's right. And Friday night, Rosemary Atungarek from Nuiqsut is coming to talk about the impacts of oil and gas development, particularly on Native people up on the North Slope.
Oh, yes. We've had her on.
That's right. So anyway, there's lots of opportunities for folks to stop by, take in a little bit of the program content, and learn more.
All right. I want to get back to this graffiti issue, but first let's take a phone call from Mike in Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mike.
Hi.
How are you, Mike?
Oh, I'm a little nervous. I've never called into a program like this before.
First-time caller, they say. Well, great. Just, we're just here to have a conversation. Are you in the food production business?
Yes. My wife, Joan, and I operate the farthest north certified organic farm in the country. We're Rosie Creek Farm. We have an 8-acre certified organic farm just about 15 miles outside of Fairbanks.
And are you one of these that has the deal where people can buy into your farm and get part of the crop?
Yes, it's called Community Supported Agriculture. I think your speaker alluded to it. And we have just over 100 members in the Fairbanks and Denali-Healy area. We're going to be going up to about 150, 160 members next year.
So you're expanding. Is there some policy barrier that is keeping you from faster expansion or spreading the word or spreading the practice?
I don't think there's a policy barrier. I think we've been farming now for about 10 years, and word of our farm got out, and the local agriculture movement sort of caught up with what we and other farms were doing, and now we had 100 members this year, and we had over 100 on the waiting list. So I don't think it's a policy issue, but I will speak to that for just a sec. I think we need to be focused on local and community-oriented agriculture as well as commodity crops. I think that Alaska agriculture has been focused in the past a lot on what the latest and greatest export crop can be that will make farmers rich, and I think that's barking up the wrong tree, especially with the cost of energy shipping things around. We need to focus on how we can produce food locally.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we all know we'll be exporting barley someday, right?
Will we?
Don't we already have the grain elevator down there in Valdez, or did they tear it down?
I can't speak to that project because I don't know a whole lot about it. But I don't think they've exported one grain of barley.
I don't believe they have. No, I think that's an excellent point. Do you have any questions or anything for LaDonna?
No, I missed some of that because I was on the phone with your producer. I think she mentioned Angelic Organics, which if anybody hasn't seen the movie The Real Dirt on Farmer John, they really ought to. It shows how a farm transformed itself from and saved it from bankruptcy by going towards producing locally, producing local food through a community-supported agriculture.
We're seeing in this odd thing in Anchorage now where the chefs are getting into the act. And I brought up about the culinary kids, too, because I like getting younger chefs involved. But, for instance, the Beartooth restaurant did a movie, because they got a movie screen in that place. They did a movie festival about food movies, and they are constantly promoting the local foods. Do you have a similar thing going in Fairbanks at all?
Not a film festival like that, but I think a lot of the local restaurants are really focusing in on local foods. We sell to three restaurants in town, and there's a bunch of other restaurants that focus and concentrate on local foods. Even the Fairbanks Princess is now promoting a local food menu for people coming in.
Well, that's great. Probably the cruise ship people really like that anyway.
Yeah, they do. And the nice thing about that is, being a small farm, we really have to get top dollar for our produce to stay in business. And selling to high-end restaurants is really a way that they can get high-quality local produce and also pay us what we think we need to make to stay afloat as a farm.
Okay, Mike. Well, I appreciate your call. Anything else you want to add? We got a pile of them coming in now.
I'm sure you have a lot of phone calls. We are starting to get I'll put a plug in for, we're starting a local agriculture group to try to train local farmers to be sort of a clearinghouse for information for the state. And it's going through the University of Alaska Fairbanks, but also the Spring Sustainable Agriculture Conference has been going on. This year will be the sixth year, and that's really a focal point for local food issues and sustainable agriculture in the state.
Okay. Well, you know, Mike, I'd appreciate a reminder about that, because we could do a show that might help push that along.
Okay.
All right, Mike.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you so much for your call from Fairbanks. Yeah, I wonder, LaDonna, if you've done any thinking about the sort of situation we have in Alaska for growing things is different. One is, of course, the seasons. We have great, huge day lengths, and that gives rise to enormous cabbages and very successful root crops. These are cabbages that, I mean, you can grow cabbage here, but the cabbages that the tourists get to look at are not, they have so much water in them, you really wouldn't want to eat them. But we have so many unique things that it seems to me the restaurants that are serving local foods, for instance, might have a role in some lifestyle choices people might want to make. For instance, I myself have discovered turnips and beets because we can grow them with such huge success here, and they store. And I'm thinking, don't you think that's kind of part of the link, that people need to think about what they want to eat that can be obtained locally? That's my point.
Oh, definitely. I think that's a big part. It's a huge conversation. I mean, we go from, really just trying to expose people to the idea that there's something going on with the food system to, okay, now what do you do about it? Do you take a policy route, a personal route, or what should you actually do? And then, of course, at the end of the day, well, what do I eat? I think that we do have to encourage people to eat seasonally. We have to encourage people to eat what's grown locally, and also still remain, very open to the idea that everything is not going to be local and seasonal. But as much of it, of our diet that can be seasonal, would be, I think, the best thing for everyone.
Are you a food miles advocate? This is one of the things that I have been hearing is such concern about energy that, as time goes on, they think about, well, how far does the food travel that people are going to need, might even have labeling of this, which, of course, would be terrible for the fresh salmon market.
Yeah, it wouldn't work for coffee for me. I mean, it just wouldn't work for me.
Yeah.
No, I am very flexible. We have a philosophy at Graffiti and Grub. It's called Soul Food Systems, and it takes the word soul and makes it an acronym for sustainable, organic, urban, or local.
Oh,
and
yeah.
What we're looking for in our soul food system is a combination of things, not just one thing or the other. We're looking for things that are, you know, grown by farmers, grown in the way that supports the earth. So we're looking for things that can be organic, maybe not. Maybe it's grown in an urban setting, maybe not. Maybe it's local, maybe not. See, for me as an African American, I have to recover my food ethic. My cultural connection to cuisine has sort of been sidelined because of some real and perceived health issues. But as an African American, I cannot have a land ethic without a food ethic. And so our project is about reclaiming the soul food or an African American traditional diet so that people can then see how to take care of the land.
That and is, yeah, Daddy, you were speaking pure poetry here, LaDonna.
Okay.
that is just gorgeous. That is a beautiful statement. You know, I think I'll throw in here, if anybody knows a recipe for collard greens where you don't have to use a lot of grease, I'd really like to have that recipe.
Oh, I got one for you.
Oh, yeah? Tell me.
Oh, yeah. I stir fry my collard greens with toasted sesame seed oil.
Ooh. Thank you.
And onions and mushrooms. I mean, you can put whatever you want. Put in it. Peppers. And I stir fry them. You lightly coat them with the toasted sesame seed oil and then add a little bit of water to it to just kind of simmer them down. And depending on how, you know, crunchy you like them or how soft you like them, you continue to add water until you get to the consistency that you like them.
My wife will be so grateful for this.
Well, and also, too, I just wanted to remind our listeners that LaDonna will be speaking free of charge at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on Saturday night at 7:30. And so if you're intrigued by what you've heard on Talk of Alaska, you want to come down and join us that evening, we'd be delighted to host you on that event as well.
Thank you. That is Ellen Mailing, a volunteer for the Bioneers Conference, is coming up, as she said, this weekend. LaDonna Redmond is our guest. She is from the Institute for Community Resource Development. And we will need to take a break in a moment, but I really have to find out about this graffiti part of your Graffiti and Grub.
Oh, we're getting there.
What is it? Where's the graffiti come in? I'm missing something here.
Well, Graffiti and Grub is really a way that my business partner and I, Will Seegers, began to talk about, you know, how to have this, you know, sustainable food conversation with the next generation. And we decided that the best thing to do was to have that conversation in the context of hip-hop. So that's where the graffiti part comes in. There are four elements to hip-hop, and graffiti is one. The other is breakdancing, DJing, and MCing are the other three. And because the youth culture right now is really the culture that's coming into power, we have to really move from having a baby boomer kind of conversation with people to having one that fits the context of the people that are going to be in power soon. So that's where Graffiti and Grub comes from. So it's a store, but it's also a concept.
Well, is there graffiti there? All right, that answers my question. Tell me where the neighborhood is.
We are in the Inglewood neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, the physical store sits right off of an expressway, which really is a physical boundary between two communities. The other one to the east of the store is called Washington Park. Washington Park, if people have been watching the whole thing around Chicago and the Olympics, Washington Park was the community that they would have built the stadium for the opening ceremonies in that particular community. So we're in between what would be called two food deserts, and the communities are mainly African American of mixed income, and they are without a grocery store.
Do you take food stamps?
We do.
I would think so. It's Talk of Alaska Food Security, the issue today. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255. Plenty of calls. Email is talk@APRN.org as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Communication Systems, ACS, offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder-to-shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about local food, shortening the food chain, taking a look at your own lifestyle and what you're actually consuming and where it comes from, and food awareness. And it seems to be kind of a transformational issue. I will say there's a very high interest in this subject. There's plenty of calls coming in. I'm getting the email. And the biggest sign of all is that the entire production crew on the other side of the glass is all eating. Ellen Mailing is with me. She's with the Vioneers Conference, and that's coming up this weekend, yes?
That's correct. We'll be at Wendy Williamson UAA all weekend, starting Friday afternoon through Sunday late afternoon.
And by telephone, LaDonna Redmond of the Institute for Community Resource Development in Chicago. And LaDonna, I assume you'll be getting on a plane shortly.
I will. I think I get on that plane Thursday.
And I hope you enjoy Alaska. I think we have better weather than you. I actually do think we're well above freezing, it may even be a sunny day today. It was yesterday.
Well, you might be a little bit ahead of us, I think. But I'm looking forward to visiting Alaska. I've never gone, and I'm excited to go.
Well, that's good. I think you'll find some surprises when you get here. Let's go to Brian, joins the program from Cordova. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Brian.
Hey, thank you very much. How's it going?
Very good. It's good to hear from Cordova.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Well, I'm the owner chef of a small restaurant called Harborside Pizza here in Cordova, and we do wood-fired brick oven pizza. And I recently, or this summer, started planting garden beds and experimented with growing some of my own produce because being in Cordova, it takes a while for the produce to get here, and sometimes at the grocery stores you can't find the quality produce that you're looking for all the time. And we had success growing different kinds of lettuce, spinach, beets, potatoes, all those things, and was able to execute a garden-to-plate style of food service in Cordova. And I look forward to trying to get a greenhouse going and maybe harness some solar power for lights also for the greenhouse.
Whoa.
Maybe do a little bit more year-round type of local food deal.
So do you have have you invented a pizza recipe, you know, that has, you know, you can call the eat local pizza?
Well, we do have I'm
trying to picture a beet pizza, and it's just not coming into focus for me.
Ooh, well, you could do a little olive oil, parmesan with some roasted beets with a little feta on top, possibly. You got something there. Maybe some caramelized onions also.
All right. So what we need is we need to get some goats here. We need to get some goats going in Alaska so we can get some cheese, yes?
Well, yes, but that's where the co-ops come in. And we participate in a Full Circle Farms co-op that sends produce. And I'm not sure if they offer cheeses and things like that, but the produce that we get from the Pacific Northwest down Washington, Oregon way, it comes up here once a week, I believe. And there are a lot of members in our community that participate in that program to get the really good produce up here and keep people eating healthy.
Thank you. Thanks, Brian, with the pizzeria. What's the name of it again?
It's Harborside Pizza.
All right. I appreciate that. Are you growing herbs there, by the way?
Yeah, we do. We grow basil and thyme, all the good Italian spices that we use for the sauce and stuff like that. So,
great. It's great to hear from you. There's a little kind of a snap in your phone line there, so I'm going to let you go at this point, but I really appreciate your call. And Ellen, he brought up Full Circle Farms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Full Circle Farms has actually penetrated this building here. Yeah. They seem to be everywhere. I had no idea they were in Cordova.
Right.
And I still don't quite know what it is, but it seems like there are some farms down in Seattle or someplace, and they ship up barge loads of food to Alaska, which people have sort of a... they put in a pre-order for.
That's correct. And it's Full Circle Farm is based on, and there are some Alaskan community-supported agriculture programs also. And basically, what those have a number of different models, but generally the consumer develops a relationship directly with the farmer and is able to receive a box of produce. Sometimes they have to go pick it up. Sometimes it's delivered to them. And it's generally a weekly share. So there's a number of different things. Full Circle is a Seattle-based farm. It's actually becoming quite a presence in Alaska. They deliver in many of the outlying rural hubs around Alaska as well. What is a little bit different about them is their use of technology to serve their customers. So they have a website where their customers can actually pick and choose what's going to be in their box and load up on the stuff that they really like. So I can, you know, limit my supply of beets if I need to. But again, you know, I think you see there's lots of different avenues out there for getting access to produce that is, as LaDonna mentioned, soulful, that it is sustainable, organic, urban and local in different, many different ways. And I certainly think, you know, having any kind of access to local foods is an improvement over buying your grapes from Chile, as an example, in our supermarket system here.
LaDonna, is there some other way of getting a complete vegetarian protein besides corn and beans?
I'm sure there is, yeah.
I mean, I'm in a soul food context, you know, the cornbread and beans sounds great, but, you know, I'm just thinking there must be other stuff.
Well, there's vegetable-based protein, certainly.
Yeah.
We talked about collard greens a little bit. It has a lot of calcium in those. And there's other kinds of beans. I'm sort of blanking on those things right now. But
That's okay.
But, yeah, I'm not a nutritionist. I don't claim to be. I'm a food justice activist. Ask me about justice.
Well, that's very good, and I would actually like to ask you about justice. Because what's really going on here is profound, I think, in a justice sense. Because, as you said, this neighborhood where you've located this graffiti and grub was a food wasteland.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, what was available in the community is primarily fast food. And the other problem with that is that it's not generally restaurants that are owned by people who are living in the community, so the money doesn't stay in the community either. So the food makes you unhealthy, and it drains the community of its resources.
Now we had the commodity thing. I remember I became aware of this when I got involved in Native American journalism, that this commodity foods were going to the reservations, and they actually talk about the commod bod. Because this really was surplus food and wasn't necessarily all that good for the people that had no choice but to eat it. Talk about justice.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, it's a food system, again, that's supported by, you know, the production of cheap products. And those products are mainly corn and soybeans. So as much corn and as much many soybeans as we can get in a product to make it cheap and inexpensive, then, you know, that's what ends up in, you know, many people's, you know, pantries.
All right. The telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422, and our email is talk@APRN.org. And here is an email now from Jen. I used to live in the year 2001 in East Palo Alto, California, a predominantly African-American community. It's on the other side of the tracks from Palo Alto, basically. There was no local grocery store there. The local high school was torn down and replaced with a mall of box stores and an IKEA. Now, there's a choice for you. The locals, myself, my landlord, etc., all wanted a grocery store. How can we, as a state, nation, city, or community, work with developers to establish local grocery stores and not yet another giant box store mere miles from the next nearest. What do you think, LaDonna?
Well, you know, my whole philosophy has been not to work with the developer.
I knew you were going to say that. I'm glad you came right out and said it.
I mean, I don't know that we can dismantle, you know, the master's house using the master's tools. I haven't found that to be true to coin. I didn't make that up. That's Audre Lorde. But we have to really get very creative about this and really begin to ask some fundamental questions, which is, you know, why aren't there more locally grown, locally owned grocery stores? What has happened to our economy, particularly the community economic environment, that does not allow an entrepreneur to open a supermarket? Why do we have to have big box grocery stores, and why do we have an economy that supports the development of big box grocery stores or big box stores like IKEA, full of cheap stuff and paying people, you know, next to nothing for wages and not giving them the health care they need, and we still don't have the products or the food that we want?
Oh, you're gonna be a fun speaker at Bioneers, I could tell, Donna.
Well, and, you know, I think, though, too, it's important. I just am reminded of the example from the Dillingham School District of a young, you know, the dietitian at the district was serving processed fish sticks that came through the federal food program. And through a little bit of negotiation and some, you know, conniving through the system, was able to work with local salmon fishermen to ensure that Dillingham kids were getting access to locally caught salmon.
Oh, yeah, that was creative.
That was very creative. And I think those are the kinds of, you know, sort of small steps that you have to take to move forward. And those were, you know, it was fishermen that were, you know, giving back to the community in a small way. Trident Seafoods helped with the processing of it. But the kids love it, and it's great stuff.
LaDonna, I know you have to go, but I want to ask you, were you for or against getting the Olympics located in that neighborhood?
I actually was for it. I mean, You know, that's why I say I'm very flexible, you know, so I'm a little weird in that way.
Well, then, you know, taken from that point of view, then, surely you can see the sort of Saul Alinsky approach, which would be to corner the developers tactically in such a way they have no choice. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I mean, and I think we have to really, you know, understand why, you know, Saul Alinsky did so much of his organizing in Chicago and developed his philosophies. You also have to understand that we have to continue to have a gender and race analysis of these issues here. And some of the things that was going on in Washington Park with a lot of people against the stadium was that it may be the indication of the removal of people from the community that have limited resources, and then, you know, those people are further marginalized by being, you know, just kind of uprooted and put someplace else.
Right, and they'll just take that old neighborhood and gentrify the hell out of it.
Absolutely, and since that time, you know, I've met people who are in London who are having a horrible time, you know, with the Summer Olympics that are coming there and all of the redevelopment that's going on and the promises that were made, particularly around developing a local food system, just are not necessarily being kept. I looked at it from a local food system perspective. I felt that if there was going to be enough money coming into the community to build a stadium, there could be enough money coming to the community to support the development of a local food system, and the Olympics being the number one target. And I had researched that the first 2 weeks of the Olympics, there's some 14 million meals that are served. And if we could somehow grow enough tomatoes or lettuce or apples or whatever that would be able to get into that food system, we may be able to create the kind of sustainable food system that we've longed for, complete with distribution and a workforce and everything that we need to make our communities healthy. So that was why I supported it. Other than that, I was, you know, it could not come. I didn't care.
But you actually, like, I've seen this. I used to live in the Lower East Side in New York City. And the furthest thing from my imagination would be that anyone would be able to garden there. I mean, there'd be so much trash you'd have to haul out before you even found any real ground. And yet, they're doing it now. They're actually growing food on the Lower East Side. You've done the same thing in the South Side of Chicago, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, and you do have to haul out, you know, all of the debris that's in the quote-unquote soil that's there, because really at this point most of those lots, or the first lots that we grown on, nothing had been on it for 30 years. So if there was any soil there, it was devoid of all fertility. And then once we dug up the soil and pulled out, I don't know, we found all kinds of stuff. We found, you know, old fire extinguishers and guns and shoes and just, you know, all kinds of, you know.
Dead stuff. Springs and not to mention
exactly.
All that glass.
It was bad, you know. Then getting that stuff hauled out and then bringing in wood chips and compost to kind of, you know, aerate the soil and build it up, and then building on top of that, you know, a raised bed system, you know, was a lot of work. But I think at the core of agriculture, we have to get back to the idea that it's not just about the food. What is so unique about Angelic Organics is that it's always been about the quality of the soil. And at the cornerstone of any healthy community has to be healthy land. And that's why that food ethic, land ethic is so important. The byproduct of agriculture is the fruit that we get, but the product is the soil. So urban agriculture and any other kind of agriculture has to increase the soil fertility so that people can be healthy, so that communities can be healthy.
LaDonna Redmond, I want to thank you so much for being on Talk of Alaska.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I hope you enjoy Alaska.
I am looking forward to it, and I'm sure I will.
Yeah. And we'll see LaDonna on Saturday night at Wendy Williamson Auditorium. That's free of charge to the Anchorage, statewide community, so come on down.
Great plug there. That's Ellen Mailing of the Bioneers Conference coming up this weekend as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
We mentioned Full Circle Farms and community-supported agriculture. We had a community-supported grower who called earlier, and I'm getting emails from them now. There was also one in called Glacier Valley Farm CSA at glaciervalleycsa.com, and there's probably plenty of other ones, and we'll try and put it, when we get this up on the website, maybe we can add those links in there if you want to send them to us by email at talk@aprn.org. Ellen Mailing of the Bioneers Conference is with us, and Seymour joins us from the Kenai Peninsula. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Seymour.
Yeah, I had one question, and also I want to put in a plug for the Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers Association, which has been trying to produce fruit here in Alaska, all over the state of Alaska for many years.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, one of the first shows we did here, we did one with Wally Hickel, and it was right before Christmas. And I said, "What you been doing, Governor?" Because he was governor at the time. And he said, "Well, I've been delivering apple pies. Is Irma Lee and I grow these apples, and we make pies, and we go around on Christmas Eve, and we deliver them to our friends and acquaintances." And I said, "What? You grow apples in Alaska?" And, you know, I later found out, yeah, he does it by heating the ground. But these fruit explorers, you my hat's off to you guys.
Well, there's a gentleman up in Fairbanks that grows, the last I knew, he's got 90 varieties of apples up in Fairbanks. He's got a south-facing hill, but he's been in this for a long time. But the other question I had was, what is an organic, I should say, pesticide or a control of root maggots on rutabagas? I've been in organic gardening for a while, and I can control them reasonably well on other things, but the rutabagas, I just cannot.
I have a hunch that we're not going to get the answer to that in this show. We only got 10 minutes left.
But
are you going to have this as a regular show?
No, we do try and come back to gardening a couple times a year, though.
Okay.
A couple, though, suggestions. Certainly, the Cooperative Extension is a strong partner with Bioneers this year in terms of our program, and they have a large number of resources available with lots of focus on encouraging people to grow locally. So that's one place to start. The other two, you know, Jeff Lowenfels has a radio show that he does, and he has been really promoting fostering the soil web through organic uses of organics to
I
control
think that
things.
That only encourages the root maggots as near as I can tell.
Right. But anyway, he might that might be an interesting issue to pose to him.
Yes,
as well.
And we'll try and get maybe Marion Owens listening, and she can join in too. She's always got suggestions. Seymour, that's the best we can do on that one.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to, Marion from Kodiak. Let's hope. Hello, Marion, line two. Marion on line two. Thank you.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. I just brought up your name, and here you are on the phone.
Well, I have two answers for Seymour. One is the Cooperative Extension Service has a publication just about root maggots in Alaska, which is the worst pest that we can deal with.
I agree.
And the other thing is he's just going to have to cover as soon as he sows those seeds. He's just going to have to use a floating row cover and just stop those critters from laying the eggs and causing the root maggots.
Okay, explain what that is. This is a way, I mean, because essentially it's a flying insect that is causing the problem.
Correct. You have essentially a flying insect that gets to the base of the plant and lays the eggs, which develop into a larva, which then are in the feeding mode and say, wow, this is great, and they just chew to their heart's content, and that's where we get the damage.
All right, Marion. Thank you very much.
Well, you bet, and I'm so proud of you for growing turnips and beets. I just can't express it.
Well, I know you frown on lettuce, Marion, and I've often thought about that, but I want you to know that I still have lettuce growing in my garden, five or six different varieties.
Well, and that's what I wanted to bring up is, somebody mentioned taking small steps, and, this time of year we tend in Alaska to hear a lot of greenhouse doors close, and I am doing a lot of experimenting with keeping those greenhouse going so that we extend not just the season, but we extend the harvest into as long as we can into the winter. And I don't know. Maybe we're just afraid of cold in North America. I don't know. But there's just a lack of winter vegetable growing tradition here, anywhere but, say, Florida and California in the South. And,
well, hey, that's easy for you to say down there in Kodiak. I mean, what about the people in Fairbanks?
I know. I'm sorry. I know. But it can be done. And I think even if we were just to push it, there's this magic kind of line of when we get to 10-hour days and less, it gets a little tough for plants, and they kind of go into suspended animation. But I truly believe that if we as individuals, even small plots at homes, can work more on not just the tomatoes and the cucumbers and all that sexy stuff, but try and grow even small 3-inch salad greens as far as we can into the winter and start as early as we can with greenhouses, hoop houses, covered raised beds and so on, I think we can seriously not only put a dent on how much we have to bring in to eat, but we can also make a message to grocery stores and restaurants and say, hey, we can do this. Maybe we need a community hoop house like what they do in Europe. I mean, we can do this in Alaska. We just have to have the will to do it. And we don't need a lot of energy to do it. You don't need to heat with fossil fuels in order to do a lot of this.
All right. Well, Marion, I want to thank you as always.
Okay, and I'm happy that you're growing turnips and beets. I really am. And I encourage anybody and everybody to attend the Bioneers Conference. It's such a wealth of information and networking. It is a fabulous, fabulous weekend.
All right, thank you. Ellen, why? I'm trying to get the connection between Bioneers and food.
Oh, it's a very strong connection because, again, Bioneers is really focused on practical and innovative solutions for people and planet. And certainly local food production has always been a program supporting that on the national level of the Bioneers organization because it's so fundamental. Not only does it really foster that personal change on a very individual level, but it leads to bringing up some issues that help us determine how every one of our choices can foster a better future. Now, you know, there's been a lot of controversy on whether organics can actually feed the types of populations that we have now. But again, over and over, when we've seen that people taking those small steps to start working on the fostering their connection with food, it often leads to some larger policy level.
Well, Borlaug's not here to argue about it anymore. Sarah Bean at Arctic Organics just sent me an email and said, agreed with Marion, the best organic rutabaga pest control is to use row covers. You just got to keep those bugs from getting on the plants in the first place. She says, thanks for the show. We are a local community-supported agricultural operation with 150 shares growing it all in the Matanuska Valley, and they're at www.arcticorganics.com. So how long have we had a Bioneers?
This is the sixth annual conference, actually, that we've done. And what's really phenomenal about Bioneers in Alaska is that it is an all-volunteer effort. We have a part-time conference coordinator that helps us get the event organized. But there's a lot of energy from a real broad spectrum of the community that's involved in putting this together.
Well, I just can't put my finger on what is exactly different about it. It's something more than positivity. But I'm not sure what it is.
Well, it's a, I think part
something
of the Bioneers
about
it,
incorporating
is,
the imagination or something.
It's really, you know, focused on problem solving. And one of my, one of the interesting examples I use is a woman named Janine Benyus, who's done a lot of work on fostering biomimicry. And she encourages inventors, those that are developing products, to, when they are thinking about how to solve a problem in technology, that they first look to nature for solutions. And that part of the Bioneers philosophy is realizing that there's an incredible wisdom of how we live our lives that's based in the natural world. And so, for instance, looking at how do you make a non-toxic adhesive, and studying mussels and the way that they adhere to any number of under marine surfaces to do that, and using those as a basis for developing solutions that are non-toxic and can help us in the future.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's exactly what I was thinking, that there may be something unique about Alaska that can make us very excellent Bioneers.
Exactly.
Because we have very different conditions here.
Well, and when you look at...
Biology is pushed to the extreme. The climate's the extreme. We're all about extremes.
Well, and the thing that's important to remember about the natural world is that no resource goes unwasted. That there's not, you know, everything that is extracted is then returned. And so that when you look at the way that an old growth forest operates, as an example, that's a very stable ecosystem where the large trees foster shade that helps the younger trees grow, that there's a lot of decomposition. Anyway, it's a little bit of a kind of going off here a little bit, but I think that's important. Bioneers is really focused on looking at the natural world for solutions, to thinking about how we can live together more harmoniously as people based on those relations.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us. Ingrid just dropped us a note saying... there is something called nematoid for maggots. That makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, anyway, just as closing, to just encourage folks to come down to the Wendy Williamson Auditorium this weekend to visit with the Bioneers. We're happy to take you in for just a session a day, or if you want to come to the whole conference, that'd be great too.
Yeah. Well, I think it's amazing. You know, it takes some loyalty to come up with the kind of money that people have to pay at the gate. So I'm glad you have a taste concept.
That's right. We also do have scholarships available for a limited time till Wednesday.
So all right. People can Wednesday's
check
tomorrow.
Check out the website.
And, all right. Thanks to Gooseberry Peter, Lynn Anderson on the phones. No, it's BD Trantina today. Pat Yak, our producer, and I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP. Teaming up with Alaskans since statehood, and together looking toward a bright future. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.